This is May Brussel, July 7th, 1978, side two, tape number 335. On side one of this tape, number 334, I was quoting from a book that I'm going to continue reading from and referring to by Michael Sayers, published in 1945, called The Plot Against the Peace. Michael Sayers also wrote the book The Great Conspiracy, and it's a background of the Czarists and the Germans and connivings of setting up World War II and laying the groundwork for World War III, the way we got into these wars. And I think that being as we're on the brinkmanship of total world wars every day and small wars every day, it's very important to study these matters. And the point I was trying to make on the other side, and I'll continue to make, is that there was a lot of forewarning early in the media, in books, magazines, and articles, of everything that was going to come down if the people wanted to see it. And that is the important thing. The mass media, the way it's brainwashed, is exemplified in this book and explained, and also references to the books, and I'll give you some titles, where the plans for Adolf Hitler were publicly proclaimed, and that there was every warning of what was going to happen if the people wanted to read it. The newspapers and magazines and books had articles about the Führer, getting ready for the Führer. They used the word the Führer, Heil the Kaiser, Heil the Army. And they were quite open about their intent to conquer the world. In 1919, there was a Reichswehr instructor, or a spy, stationed as a corporal at a depot in Munich, who was organizing the German Workers' Party and reorganizing it to fit in with the general staff of the post-war period. And the captain who gave these orders was Captain Ernest Röhm, R-O-E-H-M, who founded the Reichsflag, who was in charge of the political intrigue in Munich, Germany, when Adolf Hitler got started. One of the first spies to work for Röhm, who was discovered by Röhm, was Adolf Hitler, who was selected by the Pan-Germans to be the front for the reorganizing of Germany and the conquering of the world. Not that Hitler didn't have ideas of his own, but he was discovered by these huge corporations and was put into power. Hitler joined the German Workers' Party as a member number 7. Other members were Captain Ernest Röhm and Anton Drexler and Dietrich Eckart. And there's a list of people who later worked their way up into the Nazi Party. One was Rudolf Hess, and the Baltic White Guard, his group, and the anti-Semitic propagandist from Tsarist Russia by the name of Alfred Rosenberg. Now, the plan, as I say, it's repeated in this book over and over, take over the army, the political machinery, the academic life, and the industrial life. And then the way they could do this was to go into psychological warfare. There's a book quoted here called German Psychological Warfare, and it says that the Germans had to undergo a lot of changes after World War I, and they decided that the best way to get the masses going along with them would be a psychological rearmament after the Versailles Treaty. The General Staff threw its full weight behind the psychological rearmament plan, which, it states on page 94, the Americans, the Allies, had no understanding of the German use of psychology as a weapon of war. What was written in 1945 is true in 1978. The American people, as yet, have absolutely no inkling of the massive amount of use of mind control to control them through TV and the movies and so forth. The General Staff masked its psychological rearmament as anti-Bolshevism and nationalism, and of course, that's what we're doing today. We call it anti-terrorism and just outright anti-Bolshevism still as the secret tool to rally the people. There was a book out by Colonel Walter Nikolai called Secret Powers that was published in 1924 that stated quite openly that immediately after the armistice, the General Staff began planning war mobilization morale for the German masses. They formed the German League, the Fatherland Party, the German Workers, National Socialist Party, and propaganda was a political weapon. And the Supreme Commander, this is Mr. Lukendorf and Mr. Nikolai from the Pan-German group, they set up a staff that would require a leader in the future. They were going to create, according to their assistants, a German Führer who would carry along their secret war plans until they could come out in the open. They decided they would create what they would call a Führer, that they would have symbols, and that they have a super structure that would be easy to follow. And they rallied on the press, the radio, motion pictures, and popular entertainment in order to influence foreign nations as well as people in Germany. And this psychological work was taken over by the German general staff, the military, immediately after the armistice and the end of World War I, and 20 years before Germany proclaimed Nazi power. In 1925, Mein Kampf was published, and literally hundreds of the books and scientific treatises were written about it by the pan-German theorists, and they go into the part of the psychological rearmament plan of the general staff. Now, there are various books written here, that titles in this book, Plot Against the Peace, and I'm going to give you some of the titles and quotations. One in 1920 by Otto Spengler, who talked about the authoritarian, anti-democratic, anti-revolutionary process that would be formed, that was later taken over by the Nazis. In 1921, a book by Mr. Rubarth called Propaganda as a Political Instrument. Another one in 1922 called The Second World War by Mr. Greisiger. Another book in 1922, that's the year I was born, by Mr. K. Hesse called Warlord Psychology, A Search for the Leader of the German Future. Another book in 1922, German Propaganda and the Science of Propaganda as a Practical Social Science by Mr. J. Plenge. They used the universities and the educational establishments to help them with the psychological warfare of creating a Führer and a symbol. In 1924, a book came out called The Art of Influencing the Masses in the United States of America by Mr. Schoenemann. 1925, a book by Mr. Hoff, Economic and Political Tasks of Germandom Abroad. You see, these books laid the groundwork for all Germans all over to study. They were textbooks on how to study what's coming down, and then they could put it into action. Now, this is happening now. There's literally thousands of books out now that are going to tell us exactly how the future is going to come down. And the people involved with it can read it and understand it and study it. And the victims are too stupid. We're too busy going to the movies, bad movies, watching bad television, not having discussion groups, not sitting around and trying to understand the problem. That is except for all the people that subscribe to formerly Dialogue Conspiracy and now World Watchers International. I mean, you're a select elite group who want to get titles of books, read books, send me books and information, and are genuinely concerned with the past and particularly the present and into the future. But the warning systems were all there for Jew and Gentile alike and the future victims. It was all spelled out, and there was no excuse for stupidity except the lack of people to accept reality. And it's the reality that is ever present, and the denial of it is like digging your own grave, and that also is a reality. Whether you dig it or not, it is a reality you have to face. But when somebody else is digging it every day and writing about it, I never have been able to figure out why more people weren't curious about it. The birth of Nazi Germany, according to Michael Sayers, happened at 6:30 a.m. in the morning of March 13, 1920. That was when the first major political push of the underground German general staff. 6:30 a.m., March 13th, 1920. You might put it on your calendars for whatever it's worth. That's when the First World War went into operation in Berlin, after the First World War. And this is the date when the Pan-Germans decided that they would form what is known as international fascism. Dr. Wolfgang Kapp, K-A-P-P, led the push. He was a fanatical Pan-German. He was born in Brooklyn in the United States of America. There was General von Littowitz, his second in command, who was the Kaiser's military governor in Brussels and commanded the Reichswehr. He married a rich American woman who helped him out, and Major Pabst, another general staff agent who helped command the Pan-Germans. They got together and made what they called a new order, and for Berlin, and Hitler then was dispatched from Munich Germany by a special military plan to contact the people in the CAP's new order for pan-Germanism and set up their propaganda. All elements of the German democracy were alive at that time. They set up strikes, they immobilized the German workers. The anti-militarists were almost swept away at this time period when Hitler was brought into Munich in the 20s as their front. But they held on a little longer, like our fumbling democracy almost went completely under with John Mitchell and Richard Nixon and the multinational corporations and the aerospace and so forth, setting up that police state in 1972. We almost lost it then, and I feel sincerely we're on the brink of it now. Mr. Kapp, as I say, set up this new order, proclaimed this push, and he had some more time. He had a General von Luttwitz who handed over the command to the what were called the Democrats. The Democratic government was trying to hold up in Germany after World War I, and the man to hold it up came in and started screaming against Bolshevism, and he actually worked for the pan-Germans, and they thought they were safe. This reminds me of being on the brink of World War III and fascism and the Gestapo that James McCord talked about at the time of Watergate, and we held it for a while, and they put in a Democrat, a peanut farmer from Georgia, wearing blue jeans and fishing with his wife at 6 in the morning, and his little Amy, you know, out tugging along the sewing machine into the White House and carrying his papers and his old shoes. And he turns out to be nothing but a front. He always was for the Rockefellers. We were talking about on these programs in the Trilateral. And his military background at Annapolis with Mr. Turner, who turned out then to be the head of the CIA, and he was in Annapolis with Patrick Gray. People believe the democracy was functioning, this great election we had when Jimmy Carter was elected president. Identical to Germany, the Democrat that was put in here to save the democracy is part of the pan-German team right now. At that time, they felt that the propaganda against Russia was very necessary, that the fascist organizations were necessary to protect them against Bolshevism. And, of course, 3 years later, the General Staff took over with another big push, and they began their anti-Bolshevism with a big shove and a yell. And that's when their trained agitator, Adolf Hitler, surfaced. Now, the New York Times, January 28, 1923, reported that Adolf Hitler was marching into the Bavarian capital with his fascisti. Now, that's from the New York Times in 1923, that he had a pan-German imperial flag. The colors were red and black and white, that they had the swastika and a circle, the circle field of white, and this was going with Hitler into Munich. The German General Staff introduced Hitler to the fascist circles in the United States, and pan-German Count Hugo Lurchenfeld had married an American heiress, and she told the newspapers that in Bavaria, in quotes, we have a new prophet. He's arisen, and we have faith in him. His name is Adolf Hitler, and he will lead the Socialist Labor Party. And Hitler's creed, of course, from the very beginning, was this great anti-Semitism which rallied all of them, like Mussolini. He came along with his socialism and internationalism and the anti-Semitism, which was the glue that held this together, because there were so many Jews that helped overthrow the Tsar and create communism in Russia. This was the rallying point here. The Jews will do it here. And he juiced them all up to go after one segment of the society and give them the arms necessary to attack this handful of Jews. The New York Times, again, February the 8th, 1923, had an article that two of Hitler's lieutenants, whom the French francs and American dollars had depended upon, had been arrested in Germany. The Bavarian Diet had long had money that two people that were funded by American money had been temporarily held up. Now, Hitler was arrested for a while, but his money was coming from Henry Ford, and the New York Times says the Hitler movement was financed by the anti-Semitic chief Henry Ford in America. Mr. Ford's interest in the Bavarian anti-Jewish movement began a year ago when Mr. Ford's agents came in contact with Dietrich Eckart, the notorious pan-German. Shortly after Eckart had asked Ford for financial aid, the agent then returned to America and got Mr. Ford's money to come to Munich. Herr Hitler openly boasts of Mr. Ford's support. He praises Mr. Ford not only as a great individualist, but as a great anti-Semite. Now, the Pan-Germans were busy with Sir Henry de Terding, the Anglo-Dutch chairman of the Oil Trust, the Royal Dutch Shell, and, of course, during World War I and after World War II, Prince Bernhard, the Nazi czarist, married Queen Juliana in the Netherlands and runs the Bilderberger now and directs which countries are to be overthrown or conquered. Hitler was temporarily put into prison at the time of this great insurrection. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison. As I said before, he served 8.5 months in what they said was comfortable confinement on a military fortress at Landsberg. Now, that reminds me of the Watergate defendants and all of our white-collar criminals that go to these special prisons once they have to be confined. Michael Sayers writes, again, this is from the book, The Plot Against the Peace, one of the first persons to visit Hitler at Landsberg was the Pan-German professor of geography at the University of Munich, Dr. Karl Hofschoefer, one of the chief scientific experts on underground German general staff. Hofschoefer was the inventor of the Nazi science of geopolitics. In 1908, the Bavarian general staff sent Hofschoefer, then Major Hofschoefer, on a 2-year mission to Japan. He contacted the Japanese militarists. He planned the future of the military alliance between Germany and Japan. He wrote in his book called Die Nippon that the war between Japan and the United States was inevitable, that there would be a Japanese campaign against China that they decided upon. This was all written in 1913, and that there would be a collaboration with Japan, which, in quotes, was a natural necessity. And, of course, after the Nazis took power in Germany and Adolf Hitler was out of his fancy prison on the army base, Mr. Hofschoefer was appointed the head of a geopolitical institute in Berlin with 1,000 scientists and technicians, and they studied the problems of, in quotes, world conquest. While in prison, Adolf Hitler wrote Mein Kampf, which was a combination of pan-German, fascist, and anti-Semitic propaganda. The names that run through this book, The Plot Against the Peace, continue after World War II, and that's the important thing. I'm reading some of these names now that were important in building up Germany at the end of World War I. But then Alan Dulles, again on the Warren Commission, representative of the huge corporations, brought these Nazis. He was the main instrument of funneling them all over the world as soon as they realized that Adolf Hitler was going to lose the Second War. The goal for world conquest is there, and it really looks, I'm depressed about it, of course, it looks like they're winning. April 16, 1943, a Berlin dispatch to the New York Times revealed that the secret rearmament of Germany was underway as far back as 1921. They pointed out that Germans began experimenting with secret arms construction as early as 1921. At that time, the German Republic, had hardly been born. They were heavy industries that were devoted to new guns, and they hid them. And the way they hid them is important because they used dummy front organizations that I may do some about next week and give you the title so you can see how all these weapons and gases and ammunition could be manufactured. And they're under the names of companies in Europe that don't sound like the Krupps or IG Farben. By 1924, 3 years after the Versailles Treaty that was supposed to disarm Germany, Colonel William Taylor, a European agent of the American DuPont Corporation, wrote memorandums saying, in quotes, the German monopoly in military material is passing into the German hands. In 1925, a report of investigators from the Inter-Allied Control Commission accused Germany of secret rearmament for a Second World War. This was 1925. In Berlin in January 1925, Mr. Gustav Stresemann said that Germany, in quotes, is fully disarmed in accordance with the Versailles Treaty, and all statements to the contrary are fairy tales, end quotes. The German generals said, in quotes, what would they do? How could they rearm with only 100,000 men? Germany can't even fight a defensive war today, end quotes. The United States, the German-American press, the pan-German propaganda immediately went to the defense of the persecuted. How can you say, these lecturers asked, or the editorials asked, or the writers, that you can pick on these poor Germans? They went through a lot in World War I. In January 1925, a Literary Digest magazine called Literary Digest came out in behalf of the Germans. The St. Louis Westlake Press came out in behalf of the Germans. Pittsburgh German newspaper was denouncing the Inter-Allied Control Commission and said they're simply parasites living off the fat of the land at the expense of enslaved people. Again, a Milwaukee newspaper said the German people are disarmed. They have no interest in war. A New York German paper said that people have bad faith and they are charging conspiracies in Germany that are not true. Inside Germany, meanwhile, they were being armed, and the people that were exposing the rearming of Germany were killed, just like the witnesses to the assassinations and the conspiracies in the United States are killed. The pattern was set up by the early Gestapo, and those that warned got it. There was a Dr. Zeigner, former prime minister of Saxony, who was charged for high treason, and he was waiting his charges, and he revealed in quotes in January 1925 that the enemy powers have the connection for illegal rearmament organizations and that they are reorganizing. As I say, he was charged with treason. In January 1925, a chemist named Walter Bullerhahn was put on trial in a German court for treason. He said that there were secret arsenals, that there was a Black Reichswehr, that there was the existence of these arsenals, and that he wanted to give the information to the Allies. The German court then sent him to prison for 15 years for treason, and I'm sure he never got out of that prison alive. It doesn't say in this book, but Michael Sayers doesn't say, follow it up to say, if he lived from 1925 till when this was written in 1945. There were other authors. There was a famous editor of an anti-militarist paper, and he was convicted in a court of treason because he published facts in his journal that would have led to the disclosure of German secret war plans. And this man, his name was Odosetsky, was thrown into a concentration camp, and he was murdered there. And they have that information. In Nation magazine, March 11, 1925, an article by Edgar Ansel Maurer called Treason in the German Republic, and he said, Cap of the Cap Push, K-A-P-P, Captain Earhart, Eric Ludendorff are not traitors, just as the assassins of Mr. Liebknecht and Walter Rathau Erzberger are not murderers. It depends on the motive. A traitor is not a traitor when he seeks to restore the monarchy or institute of a military dictatorship. A venerable German pacifist like Professor Ludwig Udall, who publishes a letter calling attention to clandestine activity of the German government, is a traitor. And it was quite open that anybody who was exposing the team was a traitor, and anybody who worked for them was all right. He didn't commit a crime, and he wasn't a criminal if he belonged to these organizations that were arming and preparing very carefully the swastika, the man, the message, the way to mesmerize the people to fall for it. I have a book I'll do some tapes on in case you can't get it, by a man named Paul, P-O-L, Heinz Paul, who wrote The Hidden Enemy, similar to Michael Sayers, who wrote The Great Conspiracy, and this book I'm referring to, The Plot Against the Peace. And this is what he describes in his book about the Pan-German League in Berlin in 1930. In quotes, they had a large meeting in Berlin where the speaker's platform was occupied by the top princes in Europe, August Wilhelm, Oscar and Ida Wilhelm. They had people there dressed as stormtroopers. There were four delegates from the Reichswehr. This was in 1930. From the ministry, dignified officers lending support to the new government that was going to come into power. This was 1930. There was Colonel von Hindenburg, the son of the president of the Reich, and entered next to him. Close to Hindenburg sat Hallmar Schacht. That's the same man that I've mentioned on several tapes for the last few weeks, whose political career began in the Pan-German League. He doesn't mention here, but I mentioned it before, and it's in the other books, that Hallmar Schacht was a financier behind Adolf Hitler. He was a financier behind Aristotle Onassis and building up the German fleet after 1950. As soon as our wounds were over from World War II, he was the man behind Nasser and the Bormann Brotherhood, the Nazi organization of the Middle East. In 1930, Mr. Hallmar Schacht was pushing his agents of the Pan-German League. Behind Schacht had representatives of the German industry who represented billions of marks, people from the coal syndicate, the electric concerns. The Pan-German League had Mr. Blohm, B-L-O-H-M, co-owner of the Hamburg shipyards. Those are the ones that Aristotle Onassis was to build up with his Argentine Nazi connections. Stormtroopers, the elite guard in uniform, delegates from the Nazi party, including Hermann Goering, in civilian clothes at this time, with the party as an official of the Reichstag deputy, and then Rudolf Hess, the personal envoy of Adolf Hitler. Mr. Goering in civilian clothes reminds me of Evel Younger, the Attorney General of California, with his links to the Gestapo, the FBI, the Nazis, the secret police, the killing teams, the cover-up artists, the mass murders and terrorism in the state of California with its international connections, who's now running for governor of California in his civilian clothes. We'll do more about Younger maybe next week or the week after, both sides of a tape on Evel Younger, because he is running for governor of California. The Pan-Germans began, as I said, years earlier, and when Adolf Hitler came into power, they had been working many, many years trying to get control of the world long before they had selected Hitler as their agent. And their meetings were coming together in Berlin, 1930, described. They were getting ready to take over the world, and their next push was putting Hitler into power in the electoral process in 1933. In the fall of 1918, the general staff of this Pan-American group had taken billions of marks. In 1918, as soon as the war was over, and they put them in Sweden, Holland, Switzerland, Spain, Argentina, Brazil, and other countries. By June 1919, their emigrated capital, with which the German interests were to settle all over the world, was about 35 billion marks. The Dutch aviation flyer wrote in his book, The Flying Dutchman, that entire military aviation plants were taken out of Germany and put in Holland, that the Dornier Airplane Company was built in Lake Constance in Switzerland, the Rohrbach plant was transferred to Denmark, the Heikel and Junkers establishment was put in Sweden. All the transfers were done by the German General Staff, the Pan-American group that was put together World War I, World War II, and is now working World War III. Baron Manfred von Killinger, the Imperial Army officer, later, the Nazi Council in the United States started a company in Spain, in Echeverria, Spain, and they built new types of submarines for the Krupp family, but changed the name to look like a Spanish firm. The industrialists, the German industrialists, again quoting the New York Times, January the 30th, 1945, put huge capital foundations in Sweden, and under the Swedish Patent Office, they gave them a Swedish, with 50% of them were German firms. They resettled the IG Farben, Zeiss Icon, Bosch, Daimler and Bains companies, the huge AEG and Stemmons company. German capital went into neutral Sweden, and only a fraction of the capital which Germany had was secreted abroad. They sent much of it overseas and put it in these other countries, getting ready for the framework of what I call today's headlines. Collier's magazine had an article in 1945, February the 3rd, saying that the German firm of IG Farben had built chemical plants, was building them now in Madrid. In March 1944, IG Farben had their synthetic oil plant near Cordoba in Spain. They used a Spanish name called Calvo Sotelo, supposed to be controlled by the Spaniards, actually IG Farben, completely owned by IG Farben. The Spanish multimillionaire Juan March, who financed Franco's fascist regime and put $60 million, was actually a German spy in World War I. He was an agent of the Krupp Corporation and collaborated with Hitler's chief of the Navy, Admiral Canaris, the head of German naval intelligence. And today he's providing commercial fronts. That's when this book was written, in 1945, for German capital that was put into Spain and Spanish outlets throughout all South America. Remember, the book I'm quoting is from Michael Sayers, called The Plot Against the Peace. And the plot he's talking about is what you're feeling and reading in your headlines now. Civil rights group are crying, as I say, about the Bakke decision. A lot of people are shaken up, minorities, by the Jarvis scan. They don't make the connections of Mr. Jarvis to running the campaigns of Richard Nixon or working with Ronald Reagan or the direct links to the Gestapo that James McCord was talking about at one time and tried to stem the tide even for a few years. Portugal was a center of German financial and industrial activity. In 1945, there's a quotation in Michael Sayer's book, again, New York Times, January the 12th, 1944, saying, like Spain, Portugal teams with German agents in Lisbon is where they go on down to penetrate all of South America through Portuguese commercial fronts. As you can see, I'm only reading sections from chapters from a book by Michael Sayers called The Plot Against the Peace. For any person that wants to study the news, this is a very important book to obtain. Until next week, this is Mae Bressel in Carmel, California.